General of the Russian Staff Valery Gerasimov says that Russia has encircled Pokrovsk and Kupiansk. Experts and pro-war bloggers doubt it. Who's right? Who's wrong? A lot of it may have to do with what your interpretations are, but a lot of it may also have to do with if you just want to acknowledge reality or if you want to pretend like something else is going on. And I think when we take a look at the actual evidence, and not just from one source, but from multiple sources, as well as the history of this whole fight here that we've been talking about for a long time, I think it's going to be pretty clear what the real truth is here. And the longer that we go, especially with the West and Ukraine ignoring reality, the longer we pretend like what is happening isn't, it's like trying to go into a fight with your eyes closed and closing, just putting your hands up over your face and say, no, there's no enemy in front of me. Yeah, I can just keep going. You can do that for a while, but then pretty soon you're going to get either cold cocked in the face. You're going to get a bullet to the chest. You're going to get something bad's going to happen. And when you're talking about a war, obviously the consequences can be permanent and fatal. And unfortunately, we're trending in that direction. Let's start off, first of all, by taking a look at what General Gerasimov actually said. This was in a briefing that he gave to Vladimir Putin just a couple of days ago, in which he made this claim.
The successful operation to encircle the enemy was facilitated by the infliction of complex fire damage to formations of the armed forces of Ukraine to the full depth of their operational structure, as well as the isolation of the combat area in order to disrupt the uninterrupted supply of enemy units. Currently, the center group of forces faces an equally important task of destroying the encircled group of the armed forces of Ukraine in the area of the Krasnoarmeysko-Dmitrovskaya agglomeration.
And by the way, the Kramatorsky, that other word that he used there, I can't pronounce it. That's the Russian description of Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. Those are the two comments there that where he's saying that agglomeration, which is kind of one big area, which I'll show you in just a second. So just so everybody's clear, we are talking about the same things there, Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, and then also Kupiansk, which we'll cover at secondly. Let me show you, first of all, just kind of a view of the map here, what we're talking about. This is, the Eastern Front here. Up in the northern, central to the northern part of that, you have Kupiansk up here in the north, and then you have the Pokrovsk area up in the south. Now, when people hear that there are 10,000 Ukrainian troops encircled and captured in that area or circled off, people, you may look right at the map and you go, okay, well, I see there's kind of a big oval here, definitely not a circle, so that's not accurate. And then you look down here and you say, okay, well, this is more of a cauldron. That's three sides, but there's still this whole open part, so that's not surrounded either. Well, that's why I say part of it depends on definitions, because if you have the physical surrounding, then it's clearly not. But even Gerasimov, in that comment there he was making, he said, listen, this is to interdict the supply routes, and they have effective fire control. This gray area right here is not a physical barrier. It's just a zone to where the Russian side, from both the north in the Rodinska area and the south in the Zverove area, and actually and even into Pokrovsk itself, they now have effective fire control over this whole area right here. So any of these routes, and there's not even any real roads. The last real road was this major one right here that came into the city of Pokrovsk itself. Obviously, that's now in Russian hands, the entrance to that one. So the only thing left is just going through open fields or a handful of dirt roads. I think this one right here is a dirt road. And of course, those are within range of all the weapon systems from the Russians in the north and the south. So already, this is an effective operational encirclement. It's not a physical encirclement, it's an operational one. So they have fire control over the routes that are coming in, and then they're putting pressure on several points along the agglomeration itself. And especially in the Mirnograd area, you have coming in from the south down here in the southern part of it, up in the northern part of it. And then, of course, even into the city of Pokrovsk, they have now over half of it, and they're continuing to put pressure on more. They have more than half of it so far. So even what's already left is becoming increasingly difficult. It is not hard to figure out what the Russian operations are trying to accomplish here, is that they want to basically cut off the routes of resupply and logistics. If you can't provide ammunition, weapons support, or get troops in or out and replacement, get a weapon or medical support in or out, then it's only a matter of time before you lose everything here. You don't have to say, all right, well, the Russians, it's taken them however many months, and it has been a long time, to be able to take all these areas here. You may recall we went through some detail of this, what was the citadel here in the south and how difficult that was. It took many, many weeks for the Russians to get into that part once they even got up. But they were able to do it. A lot of this is literal house-to-house fighting. So you may think, okay, well, look, the Russians still have to take all these houses and all these streets, and so that's going to be a long and bloody case. Well, that's one way to do it, not the best way. That may be the worst way, and clearly not the way the Russians are, which they want to, like, close off these two, which is why taking Rodinska was so important and why the Ukraine side fought for it so viciously, because they understood that once the Russians control this part, and now especially these roads that are leading in from the outside to the inn on Pokrovsk itself, then there's nothing left. It's a shooting gallery. So if you try to take these handful of roads, obviously the Russians know exactly where you're going to go. They have these sighted and zeroed in on their targeting maps. They can see it in most cases. Obviously with the drones, they have visibility over all this. If you get off the roads, they're already into some of the area where there's starting to be some of the muddy season has started in some places, and it's just very hard going, even in the best of cases, off the roads, which makes you a lot easier of a target to hit with the drones and with the artillery and with the glide bombs, all of which are in place here. So that's the general situation we have in the southern part here in the Pokrovsk in the Mirnograd area. But let me show you a little bit more detail, and I'm specifically not just summarizing all this, because I want you to see it's from multiple different sources that are all reporting the same thing. So when you want to decide who's telling the truth here, the guys who say, no, we're not surrounded, we're still fighting, everything's good to go, like you have from most of the Western leaders and many of the pro-Ukrainian war bloggers, let's take a look at what some of the other experts who have a great track record of being right for the most part during this war. Let's start off with our friend Alex from History Legends, who kind of puts the whole thing into a bow.
With only one supply line left open, reports indicate that the general staff of the AFU is already withdrawing its forces from Mirnograd to avoid the complete encirclement. The fun is over, time to pull out, or there will be long-lasting consequences. The Ukraine command has to achieve this fast. If Pokrovsk falls first, Mirnograd will be completely encircled, and up to 10,000 soldiers could be trapped.
And you see, this the same thing as if Mirnograd is taken first, or if they close off that outside lip first, then they're not going to be able to get out. There is already, according to a lot of information that it's out on Ukrainian Telegram channels, and I've looked at those just shortly before we came on air here, and there is a panic on the Ukraine side, off the headlines, out of the camera side, in behind the scenes, they're in a panic because they remember the situations like they've had in the past, with going all the way back to the first of the war when the Russians first started going in that coastal town, where they were trying to cut that off, and instead of withdrawing from the area, the Ukraine side just said, no, we're going to fight to the last man. Azovstal, you may recall that, when the Azov battalion stayed behind and they didn't fight, and they held out for many months, and then all of them were lost because they wouldn't withdraw when they actually had a chance to do so. And that was in Mariupol, the Azovstal area of Mariupol. And then, of course, you have Bakhmut, and then you have Avdiivka. All of these places, the Ukraine side held on until, and especially on both Bakhmut and Avdiivka, they held on till the last buildings that they had. They would not withdraw. They didn't quit, and they still lost them. But because they wouldn't withdraw when they actually had a chance, they lost all of those troops and all of their combined experience. And so it was a clear bad situation. Same kind of situation they did up in the Kursk area, where they had this big penetration, and then when it was clear that they had gone as far as they could and they had accomplished all they could, instead of saying, all right, let's now withdraw in order and preserve all those troops, they ended up losing 70,000 troops. They kept trying to send reinforcements up to hold a losing position that never had a chance. And in every one of these cases, I said ahead of time, this is what's going to happen. There's been several other tactical counterattacks that have happened in on the Eastern Front here. I told you exactly what was going to happen. This it was going to be moving to the east, and the Russians had lost some territory. I said, but the Ukraine side doesn't have the capacity to sustain this, so they're going to lose it back. And especially in some of those areas south of Pokrovsk, I've showed you many times, that is now always all the way been retaken by the Russians, and now it's gone beyond that. So all of the troops that the Ukraine side lost in trying to push that back has now just been a net negative, because they've lost the troops and they've lost the territory. Now it appears that they're trying to say, do we want to repeat that same thing again? Because now then they have even fewer troops. They already don't have enough troops to have what we call operational reserves, so a fire brigade. You may have heard that phrase periodically, where you're going from one part of the front to another. And when there's a breach in the line somewhere, then they'll move this brigade over here and they'll stop them and sit there, plug that up until they get that solidified, and then they'll go somewhere else. They don't have enough of those anymore. So even the fire brigades themselves, like the 155th Brigade, have become so weakened, they're no longer able to perform that function. So now then you have the situation where it appears to me, at least from the information that I can gather, and it's always bits and pieces, is that in the northern part of that, let's actually run that to you real quick so you can see what I'm talking about. Up in the northern part, this is something we've been talking about for a while. There, you may recall that in August, there was a big penetration where the Russians went all the way up to, I believe, this area about up here. They held onto it for a long time, and then the Ukraine side conducted a counterattack. And for a while, they made some progress, and then they didn't. The Russians moved some troops back up and again. And then here of late, Ukraine looks like they used maybe their final. We'll wait and see how it's going to work out. But they used what was at least their only available counterattack force and fire brigade, and they literally did. They chopped off a considerable portion of what the Russians had up here. And that's useful. And I think that their purpose is what they're trying to do is come down further, because they want to also push the Russians out and take Rodinska, because they realize how crucial this road or this village right here in possession of it is to the rest of their troops down here. Problem is that the Russians also recognize that. And so instead of contesting this area up here, it looks like they have reinforced their areas around Rodinska and Volodymyrivka. And then the other one is Shakhova. So they seem to be holding on here to prevent the Ukraine side from doing exactly that. But here's the problem. While they're up here doing this, they don't have troops to stop the movements forward in Pokrovsk itself or to reinforce the Mirnograd contingent. So you now don't have enough troops here. So now that if you go back to the situation to where do you repeat Bakhmut, do you say, all right, hold every single building, every single section of the city, and force them to come in with a crowbar and get you out piece by piece? Or do you say, we need to move now because we have so few troops. If we don't get these guys out here, and then there's a penetration up in Kupiansk, for example, more on that in a minute, you're not going to have even an understaffed fire brigade. And then you get to the point to where you could have a literal collapse of the front. Now, there are people who are starting to see this, and I think that's the reason why the Ukraine side is in a panic. They realize that they don't have enough troops to hold the line anywhere. And so now then they're faced with one of the most awful decisions you can have to make in a military environment as the defender here. Do you say, all right, we're going to just withdraw from Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. We're going to reform up the line further to the west where we have some defensive positions and can put up much more fierce resistance. And so all those guys, and let's say that there are 10, there's somewhere between 10 and 5,000. It's unclear what the number is, but it's a pretty salty number. If you take all those guys out right now, and then you move them back up here into more defensible positions to where you're not under fire control, then the resupply lines are further to the west of that. Now then you can come in and have a better chance. Obviously with drones out there, it's always going to be tenuous, but a lot better than when everything has fire control over you. Do you do that? Because that makes the most military sense. But the cost to doing that means that you're also going to have to give up these political important situations. And I promise you that the Russians will make hay big time with this if all of a sudden the Ukraine side loses Pokrovsk and Mirnograd in one swoop. I mean, it will be huge. It will be a big emotional ding. It will be a morale shot against the Ukraine side elsewhere on the front, because they'll see that this is going south. Or do they do the opposite and do what they have been all these other times I just mentioned and postpone that day of reckoning? And it's important to understand, just like with the situation I told you in the beginning of the war, with the Azovstal area in these other areas, and then with the Bakhmut, and with Avdiivka, and with Kursk, all the times they refused to do what I just described is what makes the most sense militarily. All they did was postpone the inevitable. They still lost the city. They still lost Avdiivka. They still lost Bakhmut. They still lost Kursk and all the troops that went along with that. So they lost it anyway. And then they've lost the troops that they could have used to strengthen up and slow down even further the Russians beyond those points. They chose not to do that. And it was that because that's the same dilemma here. You can say, I can't give up these points here. That's what they've said every other time. I can't give them up, is to say. It's they choose not to. Not that they can't, is that they chose not to. But you will postpone the day of reckoning. So instead of like in the next 48 hours or so, say we're going to give this up there and the Russians will make hay over it and crow about it for sure. But you now have all your troops here. If you choose not to take the hard decision right now, you've just delayed the time. So now it's going to be maybe another month and a half or so, given the pace that things have gone. When you contest everything, the Russians still take a pretty good amount of time to get it done. But let's just say now around Christmas time, if it's that long, all the way through the next month and a half or 2 months, Russians are still going to crow when they get that. Except now then, instead of having another 10 or 12,000 people to form up new lines here, you've lost them all. And you've lost the city, and the Russians crowed as well because you wouldn't pay the upfront price. Now then, this, what's left, is even weaker than it would have been otherwise, than it would be if you do it this way now. And you still don't have a fire brigade anywhere else. And this way, if you move it back, then you can actually have a defended line that's like the least that you can get by with, but with a better defensive position. You don't need as many troops. And now then you can basically reform a regional reinforcement and a new fire brigade. Now then you've got another force that you can use to move back and forth to plug holes. Now, it's probably not hard to see already that all you're doing is delaying the inevitable, that there's no path to correcting, stopping, and then reversing the course. There is no path to that. Understand that as we even continue on here. But that we are going to continue on here. So let me show you, let's go back again to Alex, because he's going to show you the northern part of the Mirnograd area this time.
It was very important for Ukraine to stop Russian progression and prevent them from outflanking the entire Ukrainian battle line. So as a whole, the Russians were making gains in Udachne. They were making gains in Pokrovsk. They were making gains south of Mirnograd to the east. And they were advancing towards Shakhovy. Meanwhile, on the other side, the Ukrainians held the front line between Dorozhny and Rodinsky and also managed to stabilize the situation north of the Bulge.
And so that's the part I just showed you on the map a second ago, to where you see the Ukraine side with their limited troops did stabilize that portion north of the Bulge, as he was calling it there. That's a temporary situation here. But now then that was kind of in the northern part of that. And then on the other part where the north of the Bulge that's coming up there. Now, let me show you one other part of that, because it's also that most of that's on Kupiansk here. Now I want to look on Mirnograd, and for this, we're going to look at Weeb Union.
The Russians managed to gain full control over the town of Belahan on the eastern flank of Mirnograd. With this, they have full control over all settlements east of Mirnograd, and they are fighting within the southern parts and northern outskirts of Mirnograd, both along the northern and eastern outskirts of it. So the Russians are storming Mirnograd from several directions, the northeast, north, southeast of the northern parts, the eastern and southeastern parts of the southern parts, and along the northern flank entirely, along the supply lines leading in and out of the city. It is only a matter of time at this point before the Russians gain control over Mirnograd and Pokrovsk, as the roads have been completely cut off.
Do you see there that it doesn't matter whether you're looking at the Pokrovsk city itself, up in Rodinska, up around the Mirnograd, or even in the north part there. this whole agglomeration here, the thing that all the focus is on, is closing the gap here. Ukraine is trying desperately to prevent that, but all they can do is gain some time in the northern part there. These guys in the north here that Alex was mentioning there, their sacrifice can be useful if the Ukraine side gives the order to withdraw all those troops. Then their sacrifices actually mean something, at least operationally, to where they can get those troops out of there and reestablish in the line that would then make it harder for the Russians to move forward. That's about the best that they can hope for right now. If they don't choose the right way, the rational way, and make that hard call, then they're going to, all these sacrifices that and all the territory that was gained by the Ukraine side there in that northern bulge area will be wasted, and they'll lose the troops anyway. And then all the sacrifices they made to hold that will only be a temporary, and they'll lose those as well. That's how serious the situation is in the Pokrovsk, Mirnograd area. But as General Gerasimov said, that's one of two areas. The other one is in Kupiansk, as he explains here.
The city of Kupiansk is surrounded in the direction of the group of forces west. At the same time, our assault detachments of the 68th Motorized Rifle Division of the 6th Army, having made a detour maneuver, captured the enemy's crossings over the Oskol River south of the city, and in cooperation with the 47th Motorized Rifle Division and the 27th Motorized Rifle Brigade of the 1st Tank Army, blocked the grouping of the armed forces of Ukraine on the left bank east of Kupiansk. Units of the 14th, 43rd, and 116th Mechanized Brigades of the enemy, as well as the 1st Brigade of the National Guard of Ukraine, are surrounded, with a total of 18 combat battalions.
Okay, so that's for Kupiansk. Let me run to the northern part of this. We're going to leave Pokrovsk in the Mirnograd area and run up to the north, where we will see the Kupiansk area. Now, This area is, it seems, even less of a circle. You do see that the red area obviously is where the Russians are. This is Kupiansk. This is the center of the city right here. So the Russians do have a pretty good semicircle around. So you have a similar situation where you have fire control over these routes that are inside. This just like in Pokrovsk down in the south, the main roads that have been feeding into the Ukraine side are under Russian control here. So both of these routes in can't go to the change point in the middle of the city because they're under Russian control. So that means that they have to leave these. They can go up to a certain distance and then turn off on some of these smaller roads and then come in here to try to keep their troops supplied. But you see this gray area here, that's the gray zone. That's where a lot of fighting in a contested area. So you see the Ukraine side is really struggling to even hold on to what they have here. And these areas here, and I'll zoom in a little bit closer, so you see some of the built-up areas. The majority of the city is already under Russian control. All the way to the very center is fully under Russian control and gaining so by the day, as these darker red period or the lighter red period you can see is the most recent captured in the last 24 hours. And so the Russian, Ukraine side are holding into these areas here. But again, you have the same situation developing here to where all the routes, and so every one of these are now prevented from any kind of reinforcements, any kind of ammunition resupply, medical support, anything like that. So all this is cut off. And so the only thing the Ukraine side has is that they can go through these areas where they have built up areas in these roads that lead out. So it's limited. And of course, the same situation, these are under fire control. And any kind of situation you have along the front line right now, drones are an ever-present problem, and it is on both sides. But especially here where you can concentrate from the Russian side on all the issues, on all the roads that are coming in here, so they can be on the lookout for everything coming in here. And there's a limited area. All the Russians have to do is pay attention to here. But the Ukraine side, if they want to prevent the Russians from being supplied, it's literally all of this area, as far back as they can see. Russians can get supplies up from all the different directions. So Ukraine side, while defending and also trying to look deep, because they always want to try and interdict the supply lines for the Russians as well, they have a lot bigger area where they have to monitor. Whereas the Russians is a nice, you know, an incredibly small and reducing area down here where the Russians have to put. So they can put all of their assets in this one area, the same number of assets the Ukraine side will have to spread out and disperse over all here. So you can see this is not working out well for the Ukraine side at all. And now then we have in the Kupiansk area, Gary, if we can roll the video here from Military Summary, where they're talking about what's happening in the Kupiansk.
According to different mappers, Russians managed to encircle this block, this micro district of the city of Kupiansk, and that several hundreds of Ukrainians were caught in cauldron. And today we got video that confirms Russian progress in this area, which means that the Russians are about to finish the battle for this territory and for the entire western and the northwestern parts of the city. And then Russians will continue advancing further, most likely in the southern direction to the city of Kupiansk-Kozlovo, with the purpose to establish not just a drone, but also a physical control over the territory.
So any way you want to look at it, so we've had Alex of History Legends, we've had Weeb Union, there has been Military Summary, and of course these guys are literally tracking it every single day with Military Summary twice per day, virtually every day for all the 3.5 years, with only a couple of vacations that he's taken. So nobody tracks this stuff closer than these guys do. And these generally track with like Deep State and even the ISW, Institute for the Study of War. As bad as they are on analysis, they do keep relatively the same frontline traces. So they see, they're saying basically the same thing here. So back to that headline we had at the beginning, where the Moscow Times, which by the way is not pro-Russian for the most part, it's usually kind of negative, but the comment there is from a lot of pro-war bloggers just saying, well, they're really not surrounded. You can see physically on the ground, they are under fire control, and it's getting closer to where they may be physically surrounded. So the same situation exists in the north also, in that pretty soon, and probably not as close to as in the Pokrovsk area, in the Kupiansk area in the north, they're going to have to worry about, pretty soon they're going to have that decision point. Do they die in place and just say, we're going to stay here and we're going to make you dig us out of every building and make it cost more on the Russian side, more expensive to do that? Or are they going to get the troops out? And the same risk if they don't do it, the same cost if they try. So it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. But I don't understand how anybody is going to say everything is fine. You know, it's a tough situation, but it's not as bad as what they're saying. Because let me show you a couple of very much pro-Ukrainian sources that don't seem to be singing from that sheet of music. One of which is Julian Rupka, who we've mentioned many times, is definitely a pro-Ukrainian analyst and correspondent. You see, he's even got the Ukrainian flag in his name on his X account. And he says, listen, with Pokrovsk and now Mirnograd heavily occupied by Russian forces and more logistic routes under Russian infantry control, with increasing risk of major encirclement, the Ukrainian military leadership continues to deny the severity of the situation. No words. And that's from today, folks. That's earlier today. This is not old news at all. It's, in fact, I think everything I've shown you today from the analysis is all from today. So this is as fresh as it gets. And we also have from the Britain, another extremely pro-Ukrainian source from the Times of London. His name is Roger Boyce. Gary, if we can toss that one up there. He was also saying, I think this was actually yesterday. He says, I hate to say it, but Kiev won't last until spring. For all the EU's rousing words, there just isn't money or the will to keep defending Ukraine. And he could have added in there, there's not the military capacity to do so. Folks, we are getting into the point now. I mean, that's don't miss his statement there. I hate to say it, but Kiev won't last until spring. This is not a matter of cash. It's not a matter of giving them more ammunition, giving them the Tomahawk cruise missiles or more F-16s or more long-range missiles, et cetera, Storm Shadows, any of that stuff. It's always been about, and I've been saying this since the war started, and we'll repeat it again here, and it is playing out that way. It's about men, not money, not machines. You got to have both of those, but without the men, you could have literally all of the machines and all the money in the Western world, and it won't matter if you don't have the trained men to use them. And the Ukraine side doesn't. And so now then we're getting to the situation to where, despite what Donald Tusk from Poland said a couple of days ago, that he says, yeah, or maybe it was even yesterday, I talked to Volodymyr Zelensky. Ukraine can keep going like this for years if they need to, too. Maybe 3 years, he says. I don't know that they can go 2 or 3 months for this. Now, listen, I know I myself said earlier in this war that I was not I did not understand how the Ukraine side would not collapse at the end before the end of last summer, and that didn't happen. And so they showed that their tenacity was stronger than I expected. But don't miss this. It's not a matter of, okay, well, you were wrong then. They hung on. The balance of power was not wrong. The analysis about who has the ability to win a war of attrition was never wrong. And it's not wrong now. And instead of it playing out when I thought it might have earlier, now we're getting to the point to where you can physically see things falling apart on the front line. And the integrity of the defensive line on the entire Eastern Front is now at risk. It's no longer just a town here. Now then it's a section of the front here and a section of the front here, and there's no fire brigade to plug the gaps. There's a reason why Roger made that comment there in the Times of London, because he can see what's going on, and he realizes that for all of the optimism, it's just there's just not the raw materials necessary to continue waging war. Julian Rurka, the same thing. He says, listen, for all the optimism, you have got to pay attention. The leadership continues to deny the severity of the situation, he said. You can only ignore this for so long. And even if the Ukraine side in both cases did exactly what I recommended, it would give them the best chance and to solidify the front and to withdraw from both of those cauldrons while they still can do so under order and go into areas where they have more stronger defensive fortifications and better supply lines, better defended supply lines, so that it'll be more difficult for the Russians and make it more expensive for the Russians to continue going forward. Even if they did that, it buys them time only. It won't change the outcome. If Ukraine stays in both places and dies in place like it has in all the other ones, or if it withdraws under order, it will only change when the expiration date has arrived, sooner or later. That's the bottom line here. That's what you need to understand. There is no path. Listen to me carefully. There is no path. There is no logical, rational, identifiable path that will see the Ukraine side stabilize the front, stop the bleeding, and then in time strengthen itself, reform with military new forces, and then push the Russians out. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. And so for this claim that the West is saying, well, we just want to have all these sanctions that President Trump just put on and the 19th round of sanctions that Europe put on to cause Putin to come to the table so that he'll just stop where he's at, which is what President Trump said before. The Russians have said they find that very bewildering. They said there is no circumstances on the planet that they would ever do that, and they have the resources to make good on that claim. They're not going to. Nobody would. Listen, we're trying to get the Russian side from a position of military superiority to do what we won't even do from military inferiority, which is to recognize you can't win and the cost being too high and to have a negotiated settlement on the best terms you can get. But somehow we want the Russians to do what from a position of superiority, what we won't do from inferiority. It belies logic. And it all you've done is drag this thing out. All you've done by not acknowledging reality is increase the death toll on the Ukrainian side. And ultimately, you're going to increase the amount of territory that the Russians have. So at the end of this thing, when it's done, the Russians are going to have more territory than they do now. They will not stop on the current line of contact. And almost certainly, because we won't have this negotiated settlement on the terms that are on the table, it's not even going to be the administrative borders of the four territories. It's more likely going to be all the way up to the Dnieper River. And given enough time, it can also be Odessa in the south and Kharkiv in the north and everything in between. That's the risk of ignoring reality, because it's not hard to figure out why. You say, oh, they could never take Odessa. I mean, look how long it's taken them to get that here. Look at the military. What do you have left to defend with? If Roger is correct and Kiev could fall by the spring, that's because they don't have the integrity of the forces to defend it anymore. So now then, Russia won't have to fight for block by block or building by building. Now then, they can literally drive from city to city, drive there, because there won't be any defenders left in certain areas. And once the integrity breaks and there's like gaps in there, then there's really literally nothing that would prevent Russia from just driving in and taking what they want. That's the ultimate risk here. So I know that so many of the supporters say, no, that's not going to happen. I don't want that to happen. They haven't done it up to now, so they never will. That's sticking your head in the sand. That's being the ostrich and just saying, no, because it hasn't happened now, it just won't, blah, 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 blah. That's the result of it. But there are very fundamental, practical ways that this transpires this way, and there is zero chance. And I challenge anyone to either put in the comments here, send us an email. Gary, if you can throw our email address on the board here, that would be great. This is genuine. This is an open offer. Anybody who can say, here is a legitimate, valid path that with enough time, with enough ammunition, with enough fill in the blank, whatever you would say, that the Russians could be stopped, and then be able to say, this is important because this is a necessary component of it. In the process of doing that, you can't just say that if Ukraine gets enough stuff, they'll stop. You also have to say how Russia, having all of its inputs, all of its industrial capacity, all of its glide bombs, all of its air power, all of its artillery pieces, all of its drones, all of that. You also have to say, giving those things, continuing to expand, and they will, then all of these things here on the other side will somehow overcome it. So you can't miss that part of the equation. And I make this confidently because it can't be done. There's no path, because the manpower alone is millions more for the Russians. Remember, the Ukraine side is literally grabbing people off the street, and they've been doing it for years now, because there's just not enough manpower willing to sign up anymore. So they have to take them and grab them from the street. Even sending out summonses is not enough. Russia, and people mock them because they have to give a lot of bonuses and a lot of money away. Fine, whatever. It doesn't make any difference what they're doing. They're getting it. If it got to a serious situation, Russia could do the same as the Ukraine side there. There are millions of men that Russia could force into conscription if it ever came to it. If there was ever any risk that something started moving, all they got to do is throw a switch and they can start mobilizing just like anybody else can. And you could get millions to come in there. Many in the Russian side want that as it is. But what they're doing right now is enough to succeed. So there is no path that Russia, Ukraine could ever stem the tide and then reverse it. It just doesn't exist. And given that reality, then we as a cumulative West have to come to grips with reality and recognize that by continuing the ostrich version of what we've been doing, that we are setting the stage not merely for the loss of Ukraine, but for our own loss. Because I promise you, everybody in the world will see that the very best that all of NATO, this most incredible, powerful military formation in the history of the world, we keep bragging on ourselves saying, was defeated. And they'll go, huh, you lost in Afghanistan too in 2021. 20 years of operation. You couldn't defeat the Taliban, and they're in charge today, and they drove you out in humiliation and shame. You couldn't even shut down the Houthis, who barely have a missile force, but no air force and no army per se. You can't even stop them from interdicting in the Red Sea. Huh. And then here, after what'll probably be close to 4 years, all of the best of NATO, the entire organization, all of the NATO alliance members, now more than there were before, and you lost? You couldn't prevent Ukraine from losing? I can assure you, that's not going to go down well, and it's not going to augur well for our future security. It will fracture NATO as well, because there is enough countries and enough of these nations inside NATO right now that say, I don't want to tie my future to a leadership and people like this that can't make the rational decisions and can't help keep us safe and keep going down a path that leads to our military weakening. So there's all kinds of bad things that are going to happen as a result of this if we keep going down the ostrich path. For everybody's sake in the West and in Ukraine, I pray that we somehow wake up, even in this 11th hour and 59th minute. I hope we wake up, because if we keep going down this path and we just say, nope, we're going to continue on just with our bullheadedness, until we lose, we'll find out just how bad things can be. That's how serious things are, folks. Don't miss that. Thank you very much for paying attention today. We're going to have actually one more show today with Ian Proud.
We had a reschedule, actually, so that's less today. But we have a very big day tomorrow. We've got Alistair Crook. We've got John Mearsheimer. And Larry, I believe it's his first show since he's back from Russia. Larry Johnson.
Well, that's going to be a big day, and looking forward to that. We'll have to get Ian Proud back on as soon as we get a chance. But thanks for coming on, Gary, and squaring us up on that. Appreciate it. So don't miss tomorrow. Great lineup of shows coming in. A lot happening. You will not want to miss what those folks have to say. Thank you very much, folks, and we'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.